If it seems that news today is always grim, do you remember when Tylenol murders dominated the headlines? Here's ABC 7.
Investigators said new leads had prompted search warrants in the 1982 case. Seven people died that year after ingesting Tylenol capsules filled with cyanide that had been placed on Chicago area store shelves.
The 1982 Tylenol killings are a part of the list of heartbreaking moments released by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum as a part of their bicentennial project. We talk about that and other significant moments in Illinois history. Plus, research shows us girls are just as interested in STEM subjects as boys in school, but women are not equally represented in STEM fields as adults. Later this hour, how summer camps are working to get girls invested in tech, science, and math for life. But first, reporting from Politico shows that Governor Rauner profited from ICE detention center contracts. We speak with writer Natasha Korecki. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. That's all coming up on this hour of the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Coming up on today's show, many kids are out of school and into summer camps. We'll hear what some are doing to support and encourage girls who are interested in science. Plus, we'll continue our series of conversations with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum about Illinois' bicentennial. Their latest Illinois Top 10 list is a little different from some of the other ones we've talked about on the show. But first, when people hold public office, they have to disclose the kinds of economic interests that they've invested in. Here in Illinois, our current governor, Bruce Rauner, is worth several hundreds of millions of dollars. And his Democratic opponent, J.B. Pritzker, is worth an estimated $3.5 billion. Now, a new report from Politico shows Governor Rauner profited off a health provider that works with immigration and customs enforcement detention facilities, including those that house children. All of this as questions linger about how to reunite families that have been separated and what kinds of conditions immigrants are living in. The author of that article is with us now, Natasha Korecki, wrote the Illinois Playbook for years. You might remember her as a regular guest on our state politics segment. She recently moved on to become a national political correspondent for Politico. Hi, Natasha. Welcome back to the 21st, and I appreciate you being here today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Natasha, how did you discover Governor Rauner's financial relationship with the detention facility contractors?
Well, it's a murky maze, and that is the world of private equity. But there, essentially, there is TTCR is a former firm of Bruce Rauner's, and you know, there's been lots of stories that look at you know some of the financial transactions that TTCR has taken part in. And Rauner is required as governor to file something called a statement of economic interest. And he filed that, and there you can draw a link from this fund, which is called Fund X, and back to, and he's reported where he reports profits from, and back to the ownership of this firm that's called Correct Care Solutions. And it's that firm has been in the news a lot lately because of all the coverage of the ICE detention centers. And so there's just been a lot more scrutiny and a lot more, you know, publicity surrounding that.
Yeah, and that's the one in particular I want to focus on. So could you give us a better idea of what exactly Correct Care Solutions is, what it does, what it controls, what it works with?
Sure. So it's a for-profit firm that provides it provides medical care for correctional facilities in the United States and immigrant detention centers, including there's only four for-profit detention center immigrant detention centers in the country that house immigrant families, and Correct Care does do work with at least one of those, Carnes in Texas, which there's been a lot written about, even as recently as yesterday, about some of the conditions there. You know, lots of lawsuits that have been filed claiming, you know, care has been, people weren't getting care in a timely manner.
Right. Well, and before we get into that, I do want to talk a little bit about the money. So Governor Rauner previously said that he divested investment decisions, yet he is still earning money from this relationship. So how much money are we talking about?
So we don't know. We do know that he's making money from this fund, the fund that owns, at least in part, owns Correct Care Solutions. And we know that because he has a statement of economic interest. What It's very broad. I mean, you just have to, in the statement of economic interest, you just have to file something. You just have to disclose if it's more than $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, we would know much more if the governor and others running for public office in our state filed their full and complete tax returns. But we don't have that. So we don't know what he's put in, what he's taken out, how much money, what the extent of the profits are. But we do know they exist.
Okay. And Natasha, Correct Care, as you mentioned, does work with ICE centers, but they also have contracts with prisons and jails across the country. But when we're talking about a conflict of interest here with a sitting governor, why is it so significant that they deal with immigration facilities in particular?
Well, it's just it's an issue that, you know, these different groups that are, you know, advocating for these for immigrants and putting a spotlight on some of the conditions there are saying that if you are in public office, you have to make decisions about the direction of policy with regard to immigrants, right? So there's questions about, you know, do you send the National Guard troops down there? You know, what kinds of laws do you sign here? There was a very controversial law that actually people on the right do not like that Rauner signed last year. And there's also been a question of allowing four private detention centers in Illinois, and that's something that a local immigration group has fought really hard against. And they were among those that said, hey, knowing about this connection with Rauner, it creates the potential for a conflict. And, you know, they're going to bring this issue up again. They want a bill outlining these things. And, you know, they said if Rauner's still in office, it would create a conflict.
Well, Natasha, just to be clear, the law that you were talking about that Rauner got criticized for, was that the Illinois Trust Act?
Yes, that was the Illinois Trust Act. And it essentially just, it says that, you know, local law enforcement do not have to carry out immigration responsibilities.
That's Politico reporter Natasha Korecki. I also want to welcome to the conversation Jay Young. He's the interim executive director of the Illinois Office of Common Cause. That's a nonpartisan that lobbies to strengthen democracies. So, Jay, welcome to the conversation.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jay, we've been talking about Governor Rauner's private investments and what may or may not have been ethical. In general, what should we expect from our elected officials when it comes to their investments?
Well, I think what we want is transparency. At the end of the day, I think the citizens of Illinois should understand and know exactly what potential or actual conflicts of interest that their elected officials might have. I think the example that Natasha was just referencing is a clear example of, without, you know, disclosure of these kinds, you might not know why a elected official might make an adverse decision against the community that you're seeking to represent.
So as Natasha mentioned, and what you just referenced there, Correct Care does work with correctional facilities, which of course would pertain to the state of Illinois, but also with these immigration centers, which is such a hot button issue right now. Do we have a right to have this higher expectation of transparency that you're talking about when it comes to potential conflicts surrounding around these issues? And exactly how are we going to get to that transparency?
Well, I think that I guess there's a couple different ways in which I'd answer that question. First off, whether or not we have a right, I think we certainly have an expectation, and I think it is a justified expectation.
Right. Yeah.
That our elected officials are forthcoming with everything that that they are whatever interests they are connected with. There are potential solutions to this problem that exist elsewhere. We have a specific problem in our state with respect to our disclosure laws, but elsewhere, for example, in D.C. And other states, the answer would simply be for the governor to put all of his assets into a blind trust. The idea then would be that the governor would not know where his money was being invested. He also would not be able to make decisions about that. The challenge that we have, what makes this a particularly makes this situation a particularly interesting problem for Illinois, is that we do have these disclosure requirements. If the governor really had his investments in a real blind trust, he wouldn't be able to respond correctly to the statement of economic interest form that was referenced before. So he's in a bit of a quandary right now.
Well, Natasha,
what he should be doing.
Natasha, I'd like to get to the governor's response. What has it been?
Well, his response to us, I will note, is different than what we saw elsewhere today. So the response was just very, very pretty simple, which was that, you know, hey, it's we abide by blind trust procedures, is how they say it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think initially yesterday when he was asked about it, he said, oh, I didn't even know about this until I saw the story. And when we talked to his people beginning last week, you know, I said, you know, these different groups are calling for him to divest from this, to set up some restrictions or that kind of thing. And they said, no, he's not planning to do that. So that's his response. And then, He gave a more nuanced, or at least the administration gave a nuanced response, saying that he didn't technically turn a profit.
I think I might have that response, Natasha, that I can read. We did, full disclosure, invite the governor or someone from his office to join this conversation today. They did not respond to that request, but his deputy chief of staff for communications, Patty Hsu, did have this to say. The governor isn't involved in day-to-day investment decisions. His investments are controlled by a blind trust procedures and comply with economic disclosure laws in Illinois. The firm, which Natasha, you referenced earlier, is GTCR, still owns the investment, so there are no profits or losses. And if and when there are profits, the governor will abide by his agreement and donate any profits to charity. So, Natasha, back to you. You've been covering Illinois politics for a long time. What do you make of this response today?
Yeah, so, you know, it's a red herring. And I mean, you could say they're splitting hairs, or you can say they're trying to confuse people, which is to say, technically, GTCR bought the company for whatever amount. They haven't sold it yet. So they're trying to say, well, so there's no profit. But that's not really true. GTCR can take money out of that at any time. It owns the company along with other investors. The only way, there's not only one way to make money, and that's from the sale. The company, their private equity engages in all kinds of different practices in which they make money, all kinds of ways. They leverage the company's assets to borrow elsewhere. They charge fees to the company. They could direct care to purchase other business services from another company owned by GTCR. There's all kinds of things they could and may be doing, but we don't really know. A lot of these private equity funds are purposely opaque for that reason. And also, again, I would go back to, we would know the specific profits of all these funds if the governor disclosed the entirety of his income tax returns. And I should note that J.B. Pritzker, who's also running for governor, also has not disclosed the entirety of his tax return. And we could be, you know, we could be facing some similar iteration of this with Pritzker down the line when we start combing through his investments.
And Natasha, I'd like to get a sense from you what you've been hearing from lawyers and watchdog groups throughout your reporting. Is this an unusual breach of ethics? Like, what are you hearing from other sides?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's so these groups, so specifically, there are, you know, the ACLU has been up in arms over some of the specific, you know, all the conditions at Carnes and other places, and directly tied to this group, Correct Care Solutions. It's a problem. It's a problem of optics. I mean, no one's saying that Rauner personally did this, but what they are saying is that we all know. I mean, to say that you don't know, well, we do know, because obviously, we just wrote a story. You can find out because of what's publicly available. But you have people, you know, who David Donald Cohen from In the Public Interest, you know, he called it morally reprehensible. He called on him to call on the governor to immediately divest, saying that that not doing so is making him complicit in the torture that's happening in prisons and in these detention centers. So he was among the strongest, but, you know, after the story posted yesterday, there was just an onslaught of reaction that was very strong and pointed.
Well, and Jay, we just have about a minute left, but I really wanted to get to this idea that when we're thinking about private investments, our elected officials, what's ethical, what isn't ethical, what's typical and atypical, has the landscape changed since President Trump was elected?
I would say absolutely. And frankly, that's my biggest concern. When you're hearing every day on the news, whether it's, events taking place at the hotel, Trump's hotel in D.C., or it's Chinese trademarks for his daughter's clothing line, whether it's Wilbur Ross, whether it's Scott Pruitt, these stories are constantly flashing before our eyes. And the thing that I worry about is that eventually we start to get fatigued. And as we move into a space where we increasingly have the very wealthy individuals whose money is in a lot of different interests running for office, particularly here in Illinois, I fear that we're going to see this problem increasingly more, and I just worry that people stop paying attention.
That's Natasha Kurecki, that was Jay Young and Natasha Kurecki. Natasha is a national political correspondent for Politico. Jay is the interim executive director of Common Cause Illinois. To the both of you, I thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Listening to The 21st, I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Research shows that at a young age, girls are just as interested in STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, and math as boys are. But women are not equally represented in STEM fields as adults. Last year, women earned just 30% of bachelor degrees across STEM majors. And that number is actually up in past year or from past years. But getting a degree is not the only hurdle. Once women enter STEM jobs, they are more likely to leave their careers than their male counterparts. That's according to a study from the Center for Work-Life Policy. So why are we losing so many female scientists, and what can be done to change this, especially at this young age? In the studio with me now, I have Michelle Rodriguez. Michelle is a postdoc researcher in the Laboratory for Evolutionary Endocrinology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Also in the studio with me is Priya Bhatt. Priya just finished her freshman year at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where she majors in anthropology. Priya also grew up going to Games STEM Camp here in Urbana, and Games stands for Girls Adventures in Mathematics, Engineering, and Science. Michelle and Priya, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being in studio with me today.
Thank you.
And also on the line, we have Sarah Cloud. Sarah is the executive director of App Camp for Girls, a one-week camp where girls build apps and learn from other women in STEM fields. Sarah, thanks for joining us on the line, and welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
So Priya, I actually want to start off with you. You grew up going to STEM camps. We mentioned Games. That was one of them. The other one was GEMS, Girls Engaged in Math and Science here in Urbana. So have you always been interested in science?
Yes, pretty much.
From a very young age, what got you interested?
Just elementary school classes, learning about like geology and, you know, basic stuff in elementary school got me interested. Then once I moved into high school, going to the summer camps was really what, like, piqued my interest. And then, you know, I furthered that in high school, taking chemistry, biology, physics.
So thinking about those summer camps, what sticks with you even today as you pursue your college degree?
Mostly what sticks with me is the foundation that was laid with, like, other, you know, studying other women, studying with other women, and learning about our bodily functions, learning about what, like, makes, I don't know, the chemical and physical functions of our bodies is what we, you know, focused on in the camp. And then that, I don't know, having that personal, like, intimate connection with science is what really, I don't know, captured my interest.
And Sarah, you're the executive director of App Camp for Girls, another STEM camp for young women. Can you tell us more about App Camp for Girls and what kind of activities you do with your campers throughout the week?
So our camp focuses on girls, transgender, and gender nonconforming youth in the middle school grades. And during the course of the week, they work in teams and develop an app for the iPhone. They do all aspects of the app development, from creating the idea to coding it in Xcode and Swift for Playgrounds, doing the artwork for the app. They develop a marketing plan. And at the end of the week, they pitch their app to a panel of professionals working in the field. We have women, transgender, and gender nonconforming adults that teach them throughout the week. These are folks that work in the technology field, so they're instant mentors. And the professionals they pitch to at the end of the week are also professionals working in the field. At the end of the summer, we bundle all the apps and make them available for sale on the App Store, so all of our graduates can say they have an app available for sale on the App Store.
Well, and Sarah, how did you come up with the idea for App Camp?
So about 6-7 years ago, a woman by the name of Jean McDonald, our founder, she was at the largest iOS developer conference hosted by Apple and found herself in a room of over 1,000 people and couldn't see another woman. She thinks that maybe if she would have stood on her chair or something, she might have been able to see one, but she was really the only woman in the room, and she wanted to do something about it. And she had actually been involved with the Rock and Roll Camp for Girls in Portland, and then based this camp said, well, gee, we can do the same thing with apps. In a week, we can teach young girls how to code an app and get them interested in it, show them that they can do it, empower them with that information. And then one of the things we also do in the communities we're in is we build a community, being almost all volunteer-based. The women that volunteer with us, they become a community, and then we bring our graduates back as interns and back for other activities. So, you know, they have a community they're part of, which I think is really important for the adults and for the youth, because it can be pretty isolating being one of the only women in a room.
Well, and Priya, I think you kind of alluded to this idea that you feel that you're part of a community, you're meeting other young women who are interested in science. So how did these STEM summer camps really cement your interest to continue it past that young age?
Well, again, it was the experiment and the like processes that we were part of, learning the scientific method there, being introduced to scientific journals there. The people that came and presented for us were even like authored, Dr. Kate Clancy is, you know, mm-hmm. an authored professor and everything. And so we got to be introduced to those materials. And I think that gave us just a really good foundation for later when I got into college and we started reading the same types of materials. I felt familiar with it and like really enjoyed and was interested in those.
So what experiments stuck with you the most when looking back on it?
What stuck with me the most was honestly, after the camp, we got to be involved in a one-month experiment that was really of our own accord. It was a spit experiment, I guess, and we like tracked our menstrual cycle, and you know, we didn't know exactly what data was going to come from it, but just like being physically part of the experiment and every day having the responsibility to like spit in a little tube mm-hmm. and label it and put it in the freezer was just, I don't know, it felt like being part of the whole community, and yeah, I just loved it.
Well, you actually got to work in an experiment. You didn't just watch someone else do it. You felt like you were a part of it. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, Michelle, I'd like to welcome you to the conversation here. You're over at the Laboratory of Evolutionary Endocrinology, and you've worked with Priya, actually. So can you tell us a little bit more about what your research focuses on and what you do?
Yeah, so my research overall is looking at female social relationships and stress. And so I'm studying that right now in two different populations. One is actually adolescent girls that participated in the study that Priya participated in, but also I'm looking at the experiences of women of color in science. So basically, I'm looking at how the social environment affects your stress in biology.
Okay, and how do you measure that?
So there's a few different ways we can measure it. So with the women of color, what I'm doing is I'm having women collect daily urine samples, and then every day they fill out information about their workplace experiences, particularly something called workplace incivilities, as well as their social interactions throughout the day, their mood. And so that gives us a lot of daily experiences that we can then match up to the stress and inflammation from their urine samples.
So we kind of alluded to this in the introduction. There are significant barriers for women entering science, engineering, tech fields than, say, their male counterparts. So could you identify some of those barriers for us?
Yeah, so a big problem is just those incivilities as well as harassment. Basically, you have these day-to-day negative experiences. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of emphasis that's put on the really horrible things, like really extreme forms of sexual harassment and assault. But there's an entire culture of tolerance for a lot of day-to-day small negative experiences that get directed differentially across different types of scientists. So what male scientists often don't experience those, but for women, especially women of color, as well as other people of color, for sexual and gender minorities, they tend to be on the receiving end of a lot more of those really tiny things that in the short term don't seem that bad, but they mm-hmm. have an additive effect. Mm-hmm. And what's worse is because there's a culture of tolerating that, people that perpetrate those can then escalate. And that's where you get into the more really severe instances.
Well, Michelle, when you're talking about this, are you talking about in higher ed, or are you also finding this when they enter STEM careers? When we talked earlier about how not only are there less women receiving degrees, but those women who go on to pursue a career path, they're more likely than their male counterparts to leave that career path and pursue something else. Is that the same for the workplace as it is for higher ed research?
There's can be some differences depending on kind of the local climate, but this happens in academic science, and that's where my research is concentrated, but also in industry. I am not studying that personally, but I have friends mm-hmm. that worked at some large research laboratories that ended up doing PhD research and leaving because it's such a hostile environment. I remember a friend was telling me that the day she met with the director of the facility to say she was leaving, she was wearing a sweater and jeans, and it was she was gesturing at the outfit. It's the most ordinary outfit, and she's like, "This is the nicest I've ever dressed there," and I got so many comments about my looks.
Wow.
And it's she had to make every effort to just dress down and not draw attention to herself in any way.
Well, and Sarah, when we're hearing Michelle talk about these barriers for women in STEM fields, which I'm sure you're familiar with, in your eyes, how do camps like yours, STEM camps that are geared towards women, helping young girls gain interest in these fields, maintain interest, and do you think it gives them some tools that they will need to overcome some of these barriers?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, introducing youth to something that piques their interest and then supporting them in it, you know, that's one of the first doors you can open for them. A lot of the youth that come to our camps, if they have attended other STEM camps, they're often the only girl in the room or one of the only girls at the STEM camp even. So, you know, this all starts pretty young. And there's something really empowering about being in a room full of other girls. And, you know, something that it happens a lot in the tech field, and I hear this from women working in the tech field all the time, is they go to a conference of developers, for example, and everybody thinks they're an admin or they're in HR or something. Nobody believes that they're a coder, it seems. And that all trickles down to even really young ages. So the youth come to our camp and it's just assumed you can do this. We know they can do it. And from the first day, they're getting onto a computer and coding basic apps I'm in Seattle for camp this week. Yesterday, they learned how to do a four-button app, a Hello World app, and then a calculator app, and they loaded them onto iPods and took them home to show friends and family last night. So it's just being told you can do this again and again. And then the mentors and, you know, seeing role models in the field, and then also knowing that you can come back and you can talk to women that have been through it. The women that volunteer for us, it's really empowering to see them get together and just discuss different things that are happening in their workplaces and different strategies that they use to deal with this, that, and the other. Because the harassment isn't, you know, like the really overt, violent sexual assault that I think draws a lot of attention and horror. It's the everyday being the one asked to bring the coffee to the meeting and make the copies and do all the little tasks that just really wears on somebody and makes them feel less than in the workplace.
Well, that's kind of what Michelle was talking about, those microaggressions that add up over time and make you feel that you are less than or you are not as capable, perhaps, as your male counterparts. So when you're working with these young girls, Sarah, is sexism something that you directly address in App Camp for Girls, or is it more that you just want to empower them to know that they are capable and they are just as good at this as anyone else, or what kind of curriculum do you work with?
I mean, we don't have part of the curriculum addressing sexism in the workplace, but we do do workshops. We have someone come in and talk to them, a presentation coach, so that they can be a better do a better presentation at their pitch session on Friday. And, you know, that's a lot of, you know, working on, you know, self-esteem and standing up in front of people. In Seattle, we have somebody come in who talks about the importance of community and mentorship. So it's woven in there, but we don't have a direct, like, let's sit down and talk about sexism in the workplace. Honestly, I think by middle school, a lot of youth, you know, they've experienced it and they know it exists. They just don't maybe have the tools and language to talk about it.
Well, and I would like to get Priya and Michelle's take on this. So Priya, I'll go with you first. As a young woman, you're a rising sophomore here at the University of Illinois. What would you tell young girls who are interested in becoming scientists or going to the tech field? What would you tell them?
I would just tell them that they're totally capable and that the environment, even amongst peers, can be hostile, like in science fields. As an anthropology major, I've like sometimes felt less than maybe engineering students or like hard math students. But it's all, you know, it's all science and it's all in the spirit of, you know, understanding more about the world. And so everything is worthwhile, like all science fields are worthwhile, and you know, any questions or curiosities you have are worthwhile, and you're definitely capable of everything. So, and it's good to find like female peers in your field and stuff. Like, I know friends of mine that are in engineering, and I like to hang out and talk about any issues that we have. It's therapeutic. So, yeah, just that you're
building
capable.
A sense of community, yeah. And knowing that you are capable would be your main message there.
Yes, definitely.
Michelle, what would you tell young women who are interested in becoming scientists, whether that be hard scientists, soft science, mathematics, technology, any of the STEM fields?
So I think this is a bit of a challenge because I'd want to encourage them, but also try and prepare them for the fact that there's going to be challenges. And I think women going into the sciences need to be prepared to deal with people that aren't going to take them seriously or going to try and basically drive them out. And I think when you're really young, you hear negative feedback, which is a part of all of science. And some of it is constructive. Some of it's just designed to tear you down. And I think it's recognizing that it's not about you and that you need to kind of take a lot of that with a grain of salt and not internalize it. And I think the important thing is to have faith in your interests and your curiosity and be willing to both shake off some of the smaller negative stuff, but also be willing to stand up to anyone that's going to push you around or be ready to leave a situation in which you don't feel safe or you're not being heard.
And I'm afraid we are out of time, but I want to thank all of you for being here. Michelle Rodriguez, postdoc researcher here at the University of Illinois, Priya Bhatt, rising sophomore at the U of I, and Sarah Cloud, executive director at App Camp for Girls. To you all, thanks so much for joining us for this conversation on the 21st.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Throughout the year, we've been talking with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum about their Illinois 200 lists, which recognize important moments, people, and places in our bicentennial history that you get to vote on. The website is IllinoisTop200.com. And for the most part, these votes have been a way to celebrate our state's 200th birthday. But of course, there are dark moments in our past as well. And this past week's category was called Top Heartbreaking Moments. Joining me to talk about those events and which one received the most votes is Chris Wills, the Director of Communications and Public Affairs at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, and Sam Wheeler, the State Historian and Director of Research with the Lincoln Library and Museum. Chris and Sam, both to you, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks very much for having me.
All right, so Chris, let's start with you. There have been top Illinois movies, books, places, and inspirational leaders. And now we have heartbreaking moments. So what made you want to tackle this particular topic?
As we were looking at what events really shaped the state, what events were memorable and important, it was clear that a lot of them, or some of them anyway, were disasters, were violence, were dark moments, and we tried to think of what did they have in common, and we concluded that all those different kinds of dark moments were in one way or another tragedies. They were heartbreaking, and so we thought this is a way to bring all these different moments together into one category where people could think about labor violence, about racial violence, about natural disasters, about mechanical disasters. It seemed to us worthwhile to give people a chance to learn more about these.
Yes, I would agree that some of the things on the list we talk about all the time, and some of the things I'd either forgotten about or I'd never heard of. And I do think you had a eclectic list of tragedies, if that's something that you can compile. But when you guys were looking at making this list, how did you define what made a, quote, heartbreaking moment and how you equally represented the different kinds of tragedies that our state has suffered?
Well, we got input from a number of different historians and our partners in this at the State Journal Register newspaper. And we tried to achieve some degree of geographic balance. You don't want all the entries in any category to be just from Chicago or just from Southern Illinois. So we tried to look for events that took place all over the state and that to some degree were representative of the kinds of struggles Illinois has dealt with through the years, whether that was, facing Mother Nature when something
right.
goes wrong or facing one another when we turn violent against each other.
Well, and Sam, before we get to what got the most votes, I'd like to talk about some of the nominations. There were moments famous around the world, like President Lincoln's assassination. And then there were some things that people outside of the state may not have known about or paid much attention to, but actually led to some historic changes. And one that stands out for me is the Effingham Hospital Fire of 1949. So, Sam, could you give us an idea of what happened there?
Oh, my gosh. As we were, talking about the list, one of the things that, came through in all of our discussions that history is never really clean, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got to take the good and the bad of Illinois history to really understand where we came from. And one of the important things that I think comes out of this is that Illinois is very resilient. We have a long history of of overcoming adversity. From tragedy often comes triumph, and that's another thing that, that comes out of a list like this. And so, you know, that Effingham fire, my gosh, what a terrible event that happens, you know, around the middle of the 20th century. 74 people lost their life, including not just adults, but infants perished in that horrible fire. Now, one of the things that comes out of it, right, is safety regulations come out after that fire. We sort of, when we face these adverse moments in Illinois, we're able, I think, to be resilient and to come back and build a greater community after we face these terrible tragedies. And Effingham's one of those examples.
Well, and Sam, correct me if I'm wrong, some of the policy changes that came out of that, those were national, right? Not just statewide.
That's right. Yeah. Illinois, you know, here at the Bicentennial, what we talk about oftentimes in Illinois history is it's not just a local story. Illinois has a reach that is national and oftentimes worldwide. And, you know, by focusing on some heartbreaking moments in Illinois, it is interesting that you can see the significance that the state plays on a sometimes a worldwide level.
Absolutely. And there's also the regional level, too. So one of the ones from more recent history, something that I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with, the 1993 Mississippi River flood. Can you remind us of some of those more recent events that made the list or perhaps didn't make the list?
The Mississippi River flood is the most recent, 1993. Then there are the Tylenol murders of 1982, where Tylenol capsules were poisoned in the Chicago area and a number of people died. Another one that was relatively recent but did not make the top 10 was the crash of a American Flight 191 at O'Hare. It killed 258 passengers, 13 crew, and two people on the ground. It's the deadliest airplane accident in American history.
And it didn't make the list. Could you tell me why?
Just for whatever reason, the people who voted and,
right,
and narrowed things down to the top 10 felt that there were other events that had more resonance with them. I mean, that's one of the nice things about these lists and letting people vote is each individual decides how to define it. Is it the most historically important? Is it the most memorable in their own life?
Right.
You know, they can vote however they want to. And that one, while obviously huge in numbers, wasn't a top vote getter.
Well, and Chris, let's talk about which event won.
Well, do you want me to give you the entire top 10? Or
No. I was just saying, if Chris could give us, I don't think it will surprise anybody, but what made number one?
I will tell you what number one was and then let Sam tell you about the significance because he's really the expert. But the number one was Abraham Lincoln's assassination. It didn't technically take place in Illinois, but it certainly was an Illinois tragedy.
And to the significance?
Oh, my gosh. So when I think about these heartbreaking moments, you know, when you read the news or, you know, you're watching CNN and the story comes across and it just takes your breath away, that's one of those, you know, a heartbreaking, you know, sort of a moment. That's what it would do to me. In 1865, when people heard that the president of the United States, 5 days after Robert E. Lee surrendered his army to Ulysses S. Grant, when they heard that he was assassinated, murdered in cold blood, it took the breath out of many people, and the nation went into mourning. It's right after the Civil War comes to a virtual end, and they mourn Abraham Lincoln for a period of more than 20 days. They have funerals for him all across the United States as his body slowly makes its way from Washington to Springfield, where he's buried. They had funerals all along the way. Millions of people turned out to pay their respects to the to the funeral train as it made its way across the continent and came to Springfield for his final burial. And they're mourning the President of the United States, but I think they're also mourning their collective losses during the American Civil War. I mean, the Civil War, we're so far removed from it, we need to remember 2% of the American population died in the American Civil War. If we had a war like that today with our population, we would be talking about 6.5 million of us wouldn't make it out. And that is a tremendous heartbreaking moment. Abraham Lincoln dies at the height of his power after saving the Union and ending American slavery.
Well, and would you agree that it really changed the post-Civil War era, like Reconstruction, and how the rest of those events unfolded?
So that's often speculated. What would Lincoln have done had he lived? What would have his reconstructive construction policies have been like? It's often been suggested that, you know, had he lived, Reconstruction would have turned out differently. Maybe he would have found a way to bring reconciliation about quicker. Maybe emancipation would have been more meaningful. We just don't know. That's the tragedy of the assassination is, you know, the assassin, he brings a premature ending to Mr.
Right.
Lincoln's story.
So it's just for us to speculate.
Yeah.
And Sam, switching gears to second place, that was the 1871 Chicago fire. You have a lot of voters outside of Chicago, yet this was the moment that really sticks with a lot of people throughout the state. Yeah. So, Sam, why do you think that is?
Well, in 1871, a catastrophic event happened to Chicago with the Great Chicago Fire, decimating the city in many ways. Building codes, et cetera, brought about a lot of the destruction that took place in Chicago. A lot of good occurred after that horrific event in terms of better building codes. Chicago had an active fire department when the fire broke out, but certainly after the Great Chicago Fire, the fire department becomes world class. Really, they built that up. But the Great Chicago Fire has a worldwide impact. People from all over the world, all over the country, are donating money to the people of Chicago to help them rebuild. London takes up a collection, and the Queen even sends 5,000 books to Chicago because, as she says, surely you lost your library during this. So sort of everybody reaches out to help the folks in Chicago. And one of the things that I think is so interesting today, the Chicago Historical Society, today known as the Chicago History Museum, they solicited fire narratives from survivors. And today there's maybe 150 narratives. Basically, if you lived through the Chicago fire, write down your story and tell us what that was like. Today, you can actually do research. And you can, you know, sort of get the eyewitness accounts from people on the ground in Chicago that will tell you about what a tremendously frightening experience that was to go through and to survive. Now, not everybody survived. Something like we think maybe 300 people perished in that fire.
Well, and what I'm hearing from you guys, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, you know, the moral of the story in the Great Chicago Fire is that Chicago rebuilds. It rises from the ashes. It contributes to Chicago's story, Chicago's legacy as a city that will never stop. They will rise from the ashes and rebuild bigger and better. And I think that's the moral of a lot of these tragedies.
Yeah, and I would say some reoccurring themes during our conversation just right now here today is this idea that Illinois has its impacts beyond our state borders, as well as our ability to rebuild and be resilient and things like that. But Chris, you all at the Lincoln Library and Museum have been making these lists of different categories, having people vote on them. And this was the heartbreaking moment, but I know you have many more in store. So what's the next one that you guys have for people to vote on, and what are some of the choices?
The one that is up right now that people can vote on at IllinoisTop200.com is Top Musicians, and it is amazing. You have legends like Muddy Waters, Miles Davis, Nat King Cole, more recent acts like Alison Krauss, Smashing Pumpkins. It's just a great, fun variety of artists.
Any predictions on what might be making the top three at least?
Oh, my goodness. I would have to think Miles Davis is right up there in terms of influence. He's just incredible. Kanye West is on the list, and talk about influence but also current popularity. He would certainly be someone who I think would come out near the top.
Anybody you'd like to add real quick, Sam?
Hey, I grew up in the 90s. The Smashing Pumpkins are on my list.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. I want to thank Chris Wills and Sam Wheeler with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. They've been working on this top 200 list to celebrate Illinois' bicentennial. You can participate at IllinoisTop200.com. Guys, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is all for us today. For more info on today's show, as well as how you can contact us, you can go to our website, 21stshow.org. We are produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montecelio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks so much for listening.